Hello, this is Terrence McNally. I just learned that earlier this year, my dear friend, meditation teacher Trudy Goodman, experienced an undiagnosed medical emergency that almost killed her. Another reminder of the preciousness and fragility of life and friendship. Here's my 2015 conversation with Trudy and Jack Kornfield on the occasion of an event at Insight LA, the Mindfulness Meditation Center founded by Trudy. The event featured virtual dialogues with Jon Kabat-Zinn, Ram Dass, Tara Brach, Joseph Goldstein, and then-Congressman Tim Ryan. We talk about Trudy and Jack's personal paths, what each of their guests means to them, and tell the story of mindfulness in America over the last 45 years.
Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and it is my pleasure today to interview two leading teachers of mindfulness in America, Trudy Goodman and Jack Kornfield. Trudy Goodman has trained and practiced in two fields for over 25 years, meditation and psychotherapy. She studied developmental psychology with Jean Piaget, Lawrence Kohlberg, and Carol Gilligan. And for 20 years, Trudy worked with children, teenagers, couples, and individuals in a full psychotherapy practice. Since 1974, she's also devoted much of her life to practicing Buddhist meditation and teaching mindfulness. In 2002, Trudy founded Insight LA. And she teaches awareness and compassion practices at USC, UCLA, Children's Hospital of LA, and a variety of community settings. Jack Kornfield is a co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, and founding teacher of the Spirit Rock Center in Woodacre, California. His books have been translated into 20 languages and sold more than a million copies. And they include A Path with Heart, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, Buddha's Little Instruction Book, The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness and Peace, and A Wise Heart, A Guide to the Universal Teachings of Buddhist Psychology. Welcome, Trudy and Jack.
Thank you.
Thanks, Terrence.
Now, I've mentioned a few highlights from both of your bios, but could you each tell us, in your own words, about your paths to the work you find yourself doing today? Who wants to go first? Jack.
One of the beautiful things about path and story is that we each have a story of our spiritual path. There's a moment in our life where maybe we're a child and we're, as I did, lying out on the grass on a summer night in the East Coast looking at the stars and then imagining not that I was on top of the world, but that I was at the bottom of the earth, stuck on it by the big magnet of gravity, looking down into the sea of stars and wondering, well, who am I? How did I get to be this human being? What do I do with this? But it was also true that in my family, I had a creative scientist father who was also troubled and violent and abusive and a wife batterer. And I didn't know how to put together the good stuff and the suffering. And I'm not unique in that. Both in families or in human life, we have that. And so when I was in college at Dartmouth, I was studying pre-med, and I went from my organic chemistry class to a class on Asian philosophy and psychology, and this wonderful old professor, Dr. Wing Siet Chan, sometimes would sit cross-legged on the desk and teach about things like the Buddha's teaching that there's suffering in life, and I started to nod yes. And then there's an end to it. There's a way to work with it, to make, and I need to find this out. So eventually I graduated in Asian studies and asked the Peace Corps to send me to a Buddhist country so I could start studying in a Buddhist monastery, and did that for some years, and then came back and also studied Western psychology. And somehow through the seeking of my own healing and learning how to deal with my own emotions, my conflicts, nothing in my education taught me what you do with anger, or how do you deal with finding your own best values, or how do you love? How do you have a relationship that works? That wasn't on the curriculum in the Ivy League those days. So I had instead the second half of my education in the monastery, and it so transformed me. I came back joyful, able to forgive, much freer than I had when I left. And then I started to both study Western psychology to kind of figure out what happened to me and how do I fit back in this world. But also people began to ask us, myself and dear friends like Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, we see you learn these things. Can you teach them to us? And so we began to teach.
Now, I just wanted to double check because you said it very quickly, but you originally went over in the Peace Corps.
That's correct.
And how did you get from Peace Corps to monastery?
Well, I went over in part looking for a good teacher, and I'd read all those Zen books about Zen masters, and I wondered, do they still exist? So I asked to go to a remote place. They said, do you want to be in Bangkok? I said, no, send me. I want to go out, in the wild, so to speak. So I was on the border of Laos and Thailand in the Mekong River Valley working on tropical medicine teams, and this person came to see me and said, I know you're interested in Buddhism. There's a Western monk who's on top of one of the little mountains nearby in a ruined Cambodian temple. Do you want to go pay him a visit? So I went up and saw this man. His name was Sumedho, his monk's name, and he became a quite famous abbot of monasteries in Thailand and England and a very dear friend. And I said, hi, I introduced myself, what's up? And he said, I'd been in the military, I'd been married and divorced, I too was in the Peace Corps for a while in Borneo, and I was passing through Thailand and I met this monk who seemed so happy and peaceful. And I said, I want that. How do I do it? And he said, well, come join us. And I did. And he said, then I found this amazing teacher named Ajahn Chah, who has a forest monastery, remote forest monastery, and doesn't treat Westerners specially, gives us the same tough treatment. Of course, as a young man, you're looking at, is there anything dangerous to do around here? How can I test myself?
Yeah.
So I said, that sounds good. And immediately thereafter went to visit his teacher, who became my teacher and really transformed my life.
Excellent. You could never have foreseen what you were to do at that point anyway, because the world of mindfulness in America has changed so much.
Very much so. We had no idea. And even when we started teaching retreats, those of us who started in the 70s and then got these beautiful centers that we bought from the Catholic Church, like the Insight Meditation Society for a year round, Sharon Salzberg likes to say, we did it all without adult supervision. We were all, in our 20s or 30s. And that's when I first met Trudy.
Okay. Trudy, your path.
My path is really, it's different from Jack's and in several ways. And one of them is that I grew up in a very ordinarily loving family. I'm not perfect because no family is, but I had a basically sheltered childhood, and my dad was a scientist. He was devoting his life to public health and service, so he worked first with the Public Health Service and then with the World Health Organization. And I was taught by him, he was a scientist, an academic physician, I was taught by him to be kind of skeptical, to look into things, to really respect science, the scientific method. He was a very generous and intelligent and kind father. And my mother, too, really devoted a lot of her life to service and volunteer work and taking care of us. And so I went from that background. I was ordinarily tormented as a teenager. You can't be
it comes not with adolescence.
Exactly. And, I read all kinds of philosophy, and I was interested. And I wanted to go live in a monastery when I was 15 years old. But there were no Buddhist monasteries or anything like that. This was where my dad was working in France, and this was in France. I wanted to go live with the Russians who had escaped Russia at the time of the revolution in their monastery because I loved incense and I wanted to learn Russian and I just loved their church. And my parents really kind of freaked out. I wasn't allowed to do that. But I really felt like the longing to be free from the pressures of adolescence and to be in an atmosphere where people were doing something completely different stayed with me, but it didn't have any way to be expressed because there really wasn't anything yet that I knew about, very little in our country. Mm-hmm. So after that, you know, I just, college, marriage, became a very young mom. But that becoming a mom was actually, that was the life-changing experience for me. And I think this probably happens for many women, but it's particularly in those days, I knew nothing about labor and delivery. We didn't have all the education that exists now. And so I went into that experience completely, just really not having any idea of what to expect. And it was a huge shock to me to actually see my body doing something that I was not inviting it to do, asking it to do, and couldn't stop. It was like the feeling of being on a roller coaster and you hear that click, 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 click as the car goes up toward the summit of the highest hill. You can't get off.
Ah.
It's too late. You're going to go down that hill. You're going to have a baby. So in the course of giving birth, I'm telling this because it's unusual, I think, today to be left alone while you're laboring, but just the circumstances were such that I was, and it was scary and hard. And I had an experience then that was unlike anything I had ever had before, where I just felt that, you know, the hospital room vanished, where I was completely vanished, I completely vanished. But what I saw was this great, vast chain of being, and that this process of coming into life and passing away from life, this, I saw this infinite regress of beings being born and beings that would be born, and seeing myself at just the pinnacle of now, because it was happening to me now. And but in this much vaster context was a huge comfort. I think sometimes that we have the capacity for our minds to create experiences that help us in times of great suffering. And that was one for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, then I had a baby. I was busy. I kind of forgot all about it. I really thought this was maybe what happened to people in labor. I never talked about it. But a couple years later, my little daughter became seriously ill. She was actually dying of the most virulent form of spinal meningitis and Haemophilus B. And she was so little in that hospital bed. And there would be regular crises when she would code and everybody would come running. And I was fortunate to be able to stay there with her in her room, which was unusual, but I was lucky. And one night, that was the situation. There were all these doctors and nurses around her little body in the bed, and they had to do, I think, a spinal tap. And anyway, it was something very arduous and painful. And I was just sitting there with feeling helpless and terrified and sad. And suddenly, I felt like I saw God because I didn't have any other experience or words or names for it. But I really saw the activity of compassion, that that's what was going on. Everybody, all these people were working to save this little life. And suddenly all the fear, everything just vanished. And all I felt was immense gratitude and just my heart so touched. It took a long time, but my daughter recovered, and I'm a grandmother. She's well and happy today. But those experiences were important because later, and it was about 2 or 3 years later, that I began with that second experience. I realized, oh, there's more to this life than I thought. And so I began to look for somebody who would kind of understand what had happened or be able to relate to it. And I was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, going to graduate school at that time. And I began to go hear every visiting Swami or yogi or anybody who came to town, and they all had advice and none of it seemed right for me. And finally, I went to hear through the kindness of my friends Larry Rosenberg and Jon Kabat-Zinn, they took me to hear a teacher who became our first meditation teacher, the Korean Zen master, Daesan Sunim, whom Jack has practiced with as well. And when I heard him speak, he couldn't speak English that well. He spoke a kind of pidgin English, and his teaching, it would be things like, the sky is blue and the wall is white. And you'd think, uh-huh. But instead of that response, I started to weep. And it was completely inexplicable. Why am I crying? That's all he said. But I realized that he knew something about life that I wanted to know. He knew what I was looking for. And so I started practicing with him. And I think those early experiences were important because I saw that it had nothing to do with Zen, really, or Buddhism, or any religion or ism. These were experiences that I had in the most ordinary circumstances.
Well,
giving birth,
yeah,
a child who's very ill, these things happen.
Yeah.
They're very ordinary. It doesn't make them less tragic or difficult to live through.
Right.
But
their life.
Their life.
What worked for you in your own life then became
your
path
of
service.
And it was so powerful what happened to me in the transformation that I experienced that I really wanted to dedicate my life to exploring the interface between those two disciplines and how people could free their hearts through them.
Very good. We both know where the seeds were, and then we know that you both dedicated your lives to it. How did this event, living with a joyful spirit and a wise heart, come about?
Well, I have to say it was my idea.
Okay.
because this is the year of my turning 70, and this feels like a different birthday from any of the ones before. Of course, we like the number 7, but not quite as much when we turn 70. And I really felt like, unlike previous birthdays, this is one that I want to give some attention to. And I want to use the occasion of turning 70 in some way to benefit Insight LA. And I really thought about how. And I didn't really know how. And then I thought about LA, where I live, and some of the just some of the cultural context here. And I thought this will be a lot more fun and a lot better if Jack and I do it together. Because Jack is I'm actually 5 weeks older than Jack.
Oh.
But to his credit,
he robbed the cradle.
Yes, there you go.
Friends for many, many years, and as a couple for?
5 years.
So you thought, this is his 70th birth year, your 70th birth year, let's do it together. And then how did it become what it's become? With all the invited guests, as it were.
Well, one of the things that Trudy said right away, which resonated with me as well, is, we don't want to have a celebration or a party. That's a nice thing. Everybody says gratitude. Thank you for all those beautiful teachings, Trudy, and so forth. That's not really that interesting. It is. It's lovely to get some thanks, but after, 5 or 10 minutes, it's okay. Thank you. And if we could do anything, let's do something that invites people to come to a deep level of both teachings and their own inner understandings. And we said, well, how could we do this? And also, how could we make it creative for the day and for all those who come? And then we said, well, let's call some of our closest colleagues and friends who've been doing this with us for 40 years. And we'll do a dialogue with them. They'll be on the big screen, and we'll get to talk to Ram Dass and Jon Kabat-Zinn and Joseph Goldstein and Tara Brach and others who are coming, and not just have them say, hi, nice to see you, happy birthday, but we want to ask them, what is the deepest message you want to communicate to people in this last phases of your life, in which some of them are, like Ram Dass, or what is the thing that touched you most in your spiritual practice that you hope others can awaken to, so that there's some way of using this, yes, as a, you know, creative benefit in a beautiful event, but in another way, really inviting people to the thing that's closest to our heart, which is their own deep understanding.
What you are doing is you're creating an event that actually a key part of it is the passage of time. It is that you and I think probably all but Congressman Tim Ryan of the list I've seen are elders.
We are.
Yes.
You know?
Hard to believe, but we are.
We used to be premature elders, and now
we're not premature elders anymore. But you tell the story before about without adult supervision. You started this stuff, and now here we find ourselves. There is a bringing elders together, and who knows, you know, how many times this group will have that day.
Probably never. It's very difficult for us, well, any people who are trying to schedule a meeting to come together. But let alone these folks. And the fact that we're able to share some of what we love the most, not just from our own lives and practice, but from our beloved, you know, fellow travelers. I mean, that to me is a great joy.
And that is actually the tradition of birthdays in Buddhist countries is not that you get things, but that the best thing you can do on your birthday is to offer things. And so people love to do that. And, you know, we know even in modern psychological studies that what makes people happy more than anything is also to bring joy and delight to other people. So that's the Buddhist birthday tradition from those cultures is giving rather than receiving. And somehow we get to do both on this day. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. That certainly communicates a sense of it to me. If I were someone saying, well, what am I likely to experience? What am I likely to get? Is there anything more than what you've already said that you have thought about in terms of that message?
Well, just on a practical level, if you come to the day, you'll have a chance to do some experiential practice, to learn some meditation, to hopefully do some different kinds of meditation with some of the different teachers, to receive some teachings. And so it's a day, you could think of it as a retreat day or a workshop, or it's really a day for people to take away from their busy lives and experience themselves in a more contemplative context. But it's also at the Broad Stage, which is such a fabulous theater that there's it's a taste of maybe hopefully the stillness and inspiration of the monastery in a really urban, cool setting.
Let's talk a little bit about the guest list. As you mentioned, your peers, your fellow travelers. I'll say a name and tell me why they're on the guest list and what they mean to you, okay? Joseph Goldstein.
So Joseph is one of my oldest, closest friends and teaching colleagues. He spent many years in India training in the late 60s and early 70s and was in the Peace Corps in Thailand as I was, except he was a couple years before me. And when we all came back from Asia in the early 70s, we met together, partly through Ram Dass and some other good friends, and realized that we had studied the same thing, we were interested in the same thing. And then a group of us were invited by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, a famous Tibetan Lama of that era, who together with Ram Dass decided to start the first Western Buddhist university, Naropa University in Boulder. And so many of us came together in 1974 along with some thousands of students. And we discovered we were really teaching much of the same things in parallel. We got to know each other better. And afterward, the students would say, well, can't you lead us further? Can't you offer retreats? Can we find a place to do this? And that became a collaboration that's lasted in different forms for more than 40 years. And I respect Joseph deeply. He's a really wonderful teacher, and he's also a tremendously pure-hearted being. He's somebody who his greatest delight, it's almost like a watchmaker that opens a watch, and especially if there's something wrong with it, and kind of cleans and oils it, and then it starts to work better and it shines. His delight is to encounter the mind and heart of another person and say, here's how you can open your heart and mind and shine. And so it's been a privilege to work with him for all these years.
And you and Joseph and Sharon Salzberg were the founders of
the Insight Meditation Society, starting in 1975 in Barre, Massachusetts. So that's also been going for 40 years.
Okay. Any thoughts about Joseph?
I love Joseph. He's one of my teachers. He was a teacher who accompanied me through a really tough time in my life. So I have a special place in my heart for Joseph. And he's also been a great supporter of the growth of Insight LA. He has come and donated his time and done benefits for us. He has been so generous and so loving, and I always feel him cheering us on. I'm really happy he's going to be part of the day.
Very good. You mentioned him, so let's go to him next. Ram Dass.
I love Ram Dass too. Ram Dass is... you know, if Ram Dass were in India, there would be a big temple and he would be the saint who lived in the temple. And of course, it's important to say about saints that we have this sort of Western naive notion that saints are perfect, and saints are perfectly themselves, basically. Or I think even more deeply, and Ram Dass would say it as well, the goal of spiritual practice isn't so much to perfect yourself as if, okay, now I'm going to become this cool person or something, but it's to perfect your love, including of your own imperfections, of the tainted glory of your own humanity. And there's some way in which Ram Dass has been a cultural leader along with an incredibly dear and inspiring friend, starting in the 60s and 70s for literally millions of people. His book, Be Here Now, changed the culture in many ways. And he can walk through still or be out in public and people will come up to him from all over and say, you changed my life. You opened the gates and the doors to realize there's so much more to life than just the script I was given of being a good student or getting a good job, to the mystery of life, and to love and to devotion, which are really how he expresses his path. And now Trudy and I have been teaching with Ram Dass these last years. Oh, he doesn't travel, so we go over to Maui. And he's become, he's just become radiant. You know, there's less Ram Dass. He's brilliant and articulate and so forth, even after his stroke. But there's some way in which he becomes luminous. And mostly he's just a big heart, and he loves people in a way, looks at them with such a gaze of love. In India, it's called the glance of mercy. It's like somebody who looks at you, and you, no matter what you've done and who you are loved, and it goes in. So to have Ram Dass be a part of this is a really great blessing.
Yeah. Before I ask you, Trudy, I will tell you how far back I go. I 4 days after I got to Harvard in 1965, I went to hear Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert speak, which was my walking into the 60s, you know, with a flat top and a Madras shirt, you know. I just walked in and whoa. And then my senior year, during the strike over Harvard, you know, where there was this building takeover over the Vietnam War and so on, Ram Dass comes back from India, and he's going to speak at a hall, you know, one of the teaching rooms, and he comes in. And so in the middle of all this anger and stuff that's going on, the hall is packed. He comes in, he lights some candles, he sits on a desk and spoke for 4 hours, which some of you may have been there. And that is the book, Be Here Now.
Wow.
I mean, it really touches me.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2015 conversation with Trudy Goodman and Jack Kornfield about mindfulness meditation in America over the previous 45 years.
Your experience of Ram Dass.
I have to be honest, my experience of Ram Dass is much more recent. I saw him in Cambridge. I knew he was there. But at that time, I saw him as kind of a love and light guy, and I wasn't like that.
Oh.
I was a Zen student.
Ah.
I was really more hardcore. So I didn't connect with Ram Dass back then. As I said, but, you know, he was there, but it's really only through Jack that and Jack's love for Ram Dass that I've connected with him. And yes, have taught with him now and have done retreats with him. And one of the things that happened to Ram Dass with his stroke is that he has some aphasia. It's hard for him to find his words. So he speaks very slowly. There are pauses. And you mustn't fill in with your own assumption of what he's going to say. So it's very interesting
right. From
that
it's
point of view.
Almost.
It's a discipline. You wait. And he's learned to say very wise, loving, profound things very simply.
Yeah.
Like he describes the whole journey of our awakening into being able to be more fully present and embodied in a loving way in our lives. He said the whole thing is, and he's a Harvard professor saying this, the whole thing is a movement from the head to the heart. Very simple. And it feels true. And then one practice that he gives people now is just to slow into experience and breathe to yourself, I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. That's all.
And for those who may or may not know Ram Dass over the years, what's interesting about the post-stroke Ram Dass is he was so articulate. He spoke in paragraphs, composed paragraphs. You know what I'm saying?
He was very eloquent.
And great humor. And all of that becomes more difficult, but as you say, becomes something else.
Also poignant and touching. And I know when you first came back, because you went over and did some personal retreat time with Ram Dass starting a few years ago, and you came back and you said, I'm changed. But I mean, you were glowing. I mean, how was it?
Yeah, it was. I'm, in fact, about to do another retreat with him because the experience is very much what Jack described of sitting with somebody. I mean, all the great teachers can transmit that sense of loving no matter what. And it's very healing to bask in the light of that kind of attention. You know, you can just see your mind throwing up all of your problems and challenges and shortcomings, and it's okay.
Very good. Someone else that I know is very important to you, and Jon Kabat-Zinn.
Okay, so Jon is...
You guys go back to high school?
I was going to say, I have to go back to childhood because Jon and I met when I mentioned that my dad was working in France for a while at the Pasteur Institute, and so was Jon's dad. And one Sunday afternoon, I was 14 years old, and my parents said, we are going to visit an American family this Sunday afternoon. We'll all go together. And I was just like, oh, no. You can imagine, you're 14 and outing with a family to visit another family. So I sulked all the way over in the car. And then when we walked into their apartment, I saw this little Romeo over in the corner. And I thought, oh, maybe this isn't going to be so bad, this visit. And he and I, we really connected. You know, being American teenagers, he was a year older. American teenagers in French schools, and we were looking at what books we were studying. And long story short, we really fell in love with each other. He was the older man at 15. And so he was my boyfriend for a while. And I wanted to go to the college that was right next to his. And unfortunately, they didn't give me a full scholarship, so I couldn't. But... you know, that's how these fates are decided and unfold. But what's really interesting is that we did stay friends. We stayed in touch. Then we lost touch completely for probably 6 years, I would say. And one day, I overheard in an adjacent room his voice, and I thought, I know who that is. And we reconnected, and he was already with Myla at that time, but he was interested in meditation. And so it was through my friendship with him that I met my first teacher, and I'm really so grateful for that emerging from our friendship. And we went on to work together in
right,
the early
you were one
days
of the first
in Worcester at the UMass Medical Center.
Mindless-based stress reduction teachers.
In those days, we called it the Stress Reduction and Relaxation Program, SRRP.
Herbert Benson's relaxation response made meditation okay for Westerners.
And, you know, John had the brilliance to extract mindfulness, which was really, you could say it was the keystone of this beautiful, immense arch of the Buddha's teachings. He saw that this could be taught to everybody and everybody could benefit and nobody would have to think about becoming a Buddhist or anything like that.
It was genius. They didn't have to go Eastern. They didn't have to
give up anything
that they had, Western religion they had or anything like that.
And it was perfect for me because, you know, I wasn't one of those who went to India. I started right here in the middle of my imperfect life.
In your very American imperfect life.
My very American imperfect life. It was a natural thing for us to teach together and to be part of the early days of that
program. And for those who don't know John's work, as you're saying, he saw that you could bring it, and he brought it to hospitals, he brought it to mental health, he brought it to prisons. So a great deal of the mainstreaming began with John's work.
Oh, absolutely. He created an 8-week program, and that's what we taught at the hospital. And at first, you can imagine who would refer to something that involved meditation. So the doctors would send us the patients who were really at the end of the medical line. They had terminal diagnoses. They had intractable chronic pain. And I watched this room full of maybe 40 people, the butcher, the truck driver, the people from all walks of life, do these practices in a completely mainstream secular setting of a hospital basement and transform. They didn't necessarily get to live if their diagnosis was terminal, but they came to peace about their dying. And it was so inspiring. So that too was an inspiration to keep doing this work. And the fact that John is going to be joining us is just very meaningful to me.
And today in Southern California, Inside LA does some of that work that began with John and you as one of the first teachers.
Yes. And Inside LA was actually founded with the idea of providing both secular mainstream mindfulness teachings and Buddhist path for people who want to study Buddhist psychology, philosophy, and meditation. So, and the reason for that, Terrence, is because I moved here not that long ago, 13 years ago, and I really wanted to be part of the wider community of professional settings, hospitals and clinics and mental health and universities and so forth, although I did start in the prisons here. But I really saw that it had to be through the mindfulness, not through Buddhism. And Dr. Christiana Wolf wanted to learn to teach MBSR and asked me if we could do it together. And that was the beginning of a program that has served literally thousands of people by now. The MBSR 8-week program is, of course, the most studied intervention. The science is there. And that, by the way, is the other piece of why it went mainstream, because John didn't just teach the classes, he did the science. He conducted experiments, he was trained as a scientist, and his work was respectable science.
Excellent. So John Kabat-Zinn will be there. Tara Brach.
So Tara Brach was a long time, she's also a psychologist as I am, and a long time spiritual student. She started in Kundalini yoga, and she also had a child when she was pretty young, and did that. She lived in an ashram, I believe, for about a decade, and then realized that wearing the kind of ashram robes and doing these practices, which in certain ways really removed you from the world, was not working for her, was not what she needed for the rest of her life. And somehow she encountered mindfulness meditation and the teachings of the Insight Meditation Society and so forth, and began to study there with me and other teachers. And she was a very fine student because she was already very dedicated and had a long history of practice.
Knew how to practice.
Knew how to practice. And so after a dozen years of that, or 10 years or something, I've been training teachers now for 25 years or more, and it's one of the great joys of my life to find people who have a deep inner experience of their own wisdom and their own deep compassion, and also have some ability to transmit or communicate it. Trudy also trains teachers at Inside LA. It's one of the best things that we get to do with our lives, is see that beautiful spark and people and foster it. So she was part of one of my teacher training programs, and then began a center in Washington, D.C., IMCW, Insight Meditation Community of Washington, that has now grown very large. She's trained many teachers. And part of her own teaching, she has lived with a great deal of inner conflict around guilt, shame, body image, various kinds of things that created a lot of suffering in her younger life. And so she focuses a great deal in her teaching on self-compassion, on healing, on using spiritual practice, mindfulness and compassion, and these tools to come to a what her book title is, radical acceptance of yourself as a human being, and then the acceptance and the wisdom to live in that way with others. So she's become a very fine teacher.
By the way, I'm just remembering, I want to plug something, which is John. You mentioned John and Myla. You mentioned how you came to this as a single mother, and their book, Everyday Blessings. I just want to put a plug in for people out there who are going, you know,
my life is just
bringing up my kids. I don't even have time to. It's just a book about mindful parenting that I think is wonderful.
It's great. Yeah.
John Kabat-Zinn and Myla Kabat-Zinn.
Myla came to Inside LA. I mean, John taught at Inside LA too. But then a few years later, Myla came and she did a day for parents. And I wished I could have studied with her, you know,
when
45
the time,
years
yeah.
ago. Exactly.
Yeah. So I just wanted to put that out there for people who are going, how does this apply to me? Okay, we'll talk briefly about two more of the guests. Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio.
So Congressman Tim Ryan, he is unique in Congress in that he started a sitting group in the halls of Congress where it's non-denominational. People can just come and do whatever their practice is, but it's a chance to be quiet and reflect and be still. And when I thought about that, it's so brilliant because maybe the legislators could make some wiser decisions if they spent time like that. Tim has been a real pioneer for mindfulness in Congress with the support of John Kabat-Zinn.
Yeah.
And so we're grateful to him for that. In addition to that, he is a doll. He is such a fun, nice, good guy.
Yeah, I mean, what I think about Tim, and I've interviewed him a couple of times, is that he is the sort of who you least expect, you know?
Yes.
He's a football player, Ohio guy. You know, he doesn't have the Peace Corps in Thailand or, you know, necessarily the early experience with this and that. But he tells a story of how at the end of the 2008 campaign, in which he won, in which Obama won, he was absolutely drained from all that fundraising and stumping and speaking, and he decided immediately following the election to do a 10-day silent retreat with John Kabat-Zinn, changed his life. So what I love about Tim Ryan is that he speaks, he is every man,
yes.
and he speaks to every man, and God
yes.
love him.
Yes, and he walks the talk. He has done the practice. He's experienced firsthand what really is the most authentic reason to do this, which is our own difficulties and suffering that we get into in this life. And he saw how much it helped him and got so inspired.
Yeah, a wonderful, very easy-to-read book he has done called A Mindful Nation by Congressman
Which he gave to every member of Congress.
That's right. Sharon Salzberg, you're the third of the co-founders.
And Sharon is a dear friend and a beloved teacher across America. And she started teaching. She was 21 years old when we began teaching together. And there's some way in which she is what you might call an old soul. When she went to India, she also had a great deal of struggle and suffering in her early years, tremendous kind of pains and difficulties, and then found teachings that really transformed her heart. And she's become, in many circles, she's kind of the metta queen. And metta is a word for loving kindness and compassion. Some of her many books on these practices include Loving Kindness, which is the title of the first of her book. And she embodies it in some very pure and simple way. She's seen so much in her life, and there's a way in which her teaching comes from a channel that's just ancient in her. This is what really transforms a human being. Hatred never ends by hatred. It always ends with love. Love alone is the answer for that, which is a verse from the teachings of the Buddha. But somehow she embodies what that means, what forgiveness and compassion means. And so I'm grateful that she'll be a part of this event too.
And yet one might hear that and think, oh, she's, you know, a holy person. So no, Sharon is down to earth.
No, Sheila, right. We can go shopping together. We can go, yeah, she's all these people. That's one of the great gifts, is that each of the people that we've named is actually an ordinary American person living their life with their families, their joys, their sorrows, in the middle of it carrying some beautiful wisdom and some beautiful understanding.
Yeah. Trudy.
Yeah, I want to say something about Sharon, too, because Sharon is one of the most generous people I know. She offers her time, her expertise, her wisdom, her beautiful presence in a variety of settings that are really tough. You know, caregivers of battered women, and a lot of our work at Insight LA is motivated by my wish to serve people doing compassion-based work. Everybody, of course, but that too.
Particularly.
So I resonate with Sharon and her generosity that way.
Well, it's interesting because the next question I was going to ask Judy was about the beginning of Insight LA. What led you to leave home, come here, and start Insight LA?
I was leaving a tragic divorce. I mean, really, every divorce is so painful. But I call him my husband. My former husband and I mean, we're friends now, but our lives were entwined in every way. We worked together. We lived together.
This
we
is the second.
Taught, yes, yeah. We taught together. And he and I had to go apart, and it was really sad. And I felt, I just don't want to soldier on and be brave. I really need to, it felt like dying. I really need to do something completely different. And so I actually went to Asia and studied and practiced Dharma for a while. And then my daughter, who had gotten married, got pregnant. My mom, who had been in love with and lived with my dad, I mean, she was in love with him in elementary school. So she was made up at least as much of him as of herself. My dad passed away, and they had just moved to L.A. So my mom needed help. My daughter was having her first baby. I came to visit and to help out. I had no idea of Insight L.A. or anything. In fact, I had no idea that I would live here. And I didn't think I would. I didn't know anybody here except them. Nobody. And one teacher I met. But what happened was I saw that they weren't going to not need me in the future. It wasn't going to stop. I couldn't just do a visit and help out.
Yeah, did my thing.
Exactly. I needed to stay and help out. And around that time of facing that truth, finding a place to live and starting a little bit of a new life here, I met the friend of a cousin. I was introduced to Sarah Davidson, and you were there at
That's the very beginning. That's right.
A little group of people meditating in Sarah's living room.
That's right.
And that's how it started. And I have to say, honestly, I wish I could say I had this beautiful vision of what would unfold and how it would be, but I didn't. It grew very organically. It was completely homemade, like cooking from scratch. I did everything for a long time. And then because of the power of the practice and because I was joined by many wonderful people who came to help, and because the wave of mindfulness entering our so many different sectors of our society, these things
the
were...
The timing.
The timing was right.
And the fact that there wasn't something here already.
Well, L.A. is a hardship post for a mindfulness teacher. You know, it wasn't... In those days, there was no such thing, even 13 years ago.
Yeah.
It was all Buddhist
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And by my bringing mindfulness in, I mean... Some of my friends were just like, well, mindfulness? Why? That's where things were here 13 years ago. LA was ready. We were there.
There was a wave.
Oh, happening. I was saying that it's a hardship post for a teacher because it's expensive to live here.
Yes.
It's hard. And I came as a middle-aged woman. I was not independently wealthy. It was scary. And that's actually when I reconnected with Jack. And this is important because Jack and I knew each other when we were in our 20s. I sat the second retreat he ever taught or something. I mean, it was Ram Dass was there, Larry Rosenberg, Jon Kabat-Zinn. We were all learning with you. And
you were a good student, I can say that.
And
it worked out well.
Yes, it did.
And so Jack, when he heard I was in California, he started calling and asking if I wanted to learn to be a Vipassana teacher. I had been teaching Zen. And so he asked if I wanted to learn to be a Vipassana teacher. And I have to admit, I was a little bit reluctant. I was like, I'm never going to be your point person for Spirit Rock in LA. And never name the well from which you will not drink. And so I actually went and Jack mentored me to shift and become a Vipassana teacher.
In other words, he'd started too at this point.
Yeah. And we just got to be friends and started to teach together because we were just on the same wavelength. You know, it'd be one of those things where you would both hear the same thing and your eyes would meet. We were on the same wavelength. And we began to teach together a lot and we enjoyed it.
Very good. You know, I would have asked those questions. What were your hopes for Insight LA at the time? But really, you've already said it was a step at a time.
It was.
It was one foot in front of the other.
It was.
What are some of the programs you're most excited about these days?
At Insight LA?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited that after 12 years. I think it'll be 13 this fall, yes. After almost 13 years of teaching mindfulness, of teaching Buddhism, of doing what we do in our community. And we've been able to teach. I think one of the most exciting things about what we have done is the Being with Death and Dying retreats for professional caregivers who work at the bedside of critically ill and dying children. And then we expanded for adults and hospice. And that work has been so rewarding and so beautiful and so needed in the community. We've trained the staff at the VA hospital with a big grant there. I mean, these are some of the things we've done like out in the community, as well as teach in mental health clinics and schools and just a variety of settings. But what I'm excited about going forward is that we were blessed to receive a grant to be able to do some social justice work. And what I mean by that is to serve people who would not be able to afford to come take classes at our center and to go into some of the most intense areas of suffering and offer teachings to help. So, for example, we've started a program at the Downtown Women's center, which serves homeless women, and working with the staff, and soon we're going to be working with the clients as well. A program at Step Up to bring mindfulness to people who are struggling with mental illness, sometimes homelessness also. And it's very interesting because these practices can be adapted to help so many different kinds of people. And we think, for example, mental illness, well, that would preclude it. But it's really a continuum. We all have moments when we're mentally so out of balance. We have thoughts and feelings that could be called quite sick, actually, if we were being judgmental about them. And the people who spend more time, perhaps,
at that end of the continuum,
they can learn to, for example, there was a fabulous study done with schizophrenic people where this is with an inpatient group where people learned to be mindful of their voices instead of just doing what their voices were telling them to do. And there was a 49% decrease in hospitalizations in that group.
Still hearing the voices.
And they, of course, they're not. They're still schizophrenic. Yeah. We don't have a cure for that, sadly. And so that's just, I'm excited about being able to reach people who are underserved and that we have the ability now to send teachers. People don't have to come to the West Side or to Los Feliz. We have the ability to send teachers to where they need to be. So I have a vision of L.A. in the future being really a powerful center of mindfulness, of, you know, we're trendsetters in fashion and music and all kinds of areas. Maybe we can begin to be in terms of the spread of compassion, of loving awareness, of mindfulness practices.
Well, having you know, from the sidelines, having watched the growth of Inside LA, I think you're onto something there. I'm Terrence McNally. Thank you, Trudy Goodman. Thank you, Jack Kornfield.
Thank you, Terrence.
Thank you, Terrence. It's been a pleasure.